Okay, so here's a topic, one of my favorite topics, sin and grace. Now, from now on, in my little opinion at least, all the topics start to get real specific and therefore, I think, a lot more interesting as we move along now. And here's something real, and I hope what we go over tonight will really help you and really answer a lot of your questions, because there are huge misunderstandings on this subject. Like, we talk about sin, oceans of misunderstanding about what people think. And grace, quite honestly, most people don't have any idea what it is. There's lots of ignorance. So huge misunderstanding about sin and big, big oceans filled with ignorance about grace. And what I'm hoping is this evening we can make a big difference for that, okay? So we're going to talk about sin first, then we're going to talk about grace, right? So let's talk about sin. And the way we're going to talk about sin is we're going to talk about it in categories, because that's the only way I know how to do it. Okay. First thing we're going to do is we're going to say there's two big, big overarching categories when we talk about what sin is. There's original sin and there's personal sin, or sometimes I also call it actual sin. Raise your hand if you've heard of original sin. Raise your hand if you know that it has to do with Adam and Eve and the apple. Okay, good. So I don't have to reintroduce that. But allow me just tell you a little bit of original sin. No, one more question. Raise your hand if you have thought of Adam and Eve and original sin and you've thought, that's really unfair. I didn't do anything wrong. Thought ever crossed your mind? Maybe I'm just a church geek and think about these things, but I always used to think that. I didn't do anything wrong. Why should I have to suffer? Anyway, we'll talk about this. Original sin. First thing we want to understand about original sin is that calling it a sin, it's actually kind of a misnomer. Okay? Because did you do anything that made you guilty of original sin, yes or no?
No.
You didn't do anything, did you? Okay? It's a condition that you inherited. It wasn't your sin. So when we talk about original sin, please don't think of it as like you're guilty of something that you did. It's a condition that you inherited, okay? And here's what it is. It's a privation, a deprivation of God's grace. And we're going to talk about grace in a moment, okay? But it's an inherited condition. Now let's talk about an inherited condition for just a moment. I'm going to jump to the end of this little section here, but I say it's not fair. Well, actually, before I get to that, let's talk about some of the conditions, some of the facts of this. You're broken as a human being. Are you aware of that? You're aware that despite your best efforts, you keep doing the wrong thing? You've woken up in the morning and said to yourself, today I'm going to make a great new difference. Today, I'm going to eat healthy. And what happens? You have a Melba toast and a little bit of low-fat cottage cheese and herbal tea for breakfast. And by lunch, you have a ham sandwich and an Oreo cookie. And by late afternoon, you have the rest of the bag of the Oreo cookies. Right? And for evening, you've got a steak and French fries and a double milkshake. And you say to yourself, what went wrong? Well, you're broken. You have the best of intentions. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Why are we like that? Why isn't it the other way around? Why can't we just effortlessly do great things and it has to really be hard to do the wrong thing? You ever thought about this before? You've noticed this is your condition, right? It's easy to procrastinate, watch TV or play a computer game or talk to your friends or whatever, and it's hard to buckle down and study. Why can't it be the reverse? Why can't it be easy to buckle down and study and really hard to break away from all that? Why? It's the consequences of original sin. Something's wrong with this creature. You didn't do anything to do that, but it is a condition that you inherited. You were born that way. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, this is what I talk about when I say, isn't it unfair? You didn't do anything to be born that way. And in a sense, it kind of is unfair. But here's the facts about human nature. What we do affects each other, for good and for ill. So if you take an airplane, you have to take off your shoes before you get on the plane because some idiot decided to try to bomb the airplane with a bomb in his shoe. you didn't try to bomb the airplane with a bomb in your shoe, but you sure do have to pay the penalty for it. What we do affects one another. The good news is it works in reverse as well. When someone does something good, everybody benefits from it. We're all ennobled by somebody's good example. Okay? So we've got the original sin that you didn't do, but you definitely inherited, and it's not fair. Okay? But also, you didn't have to die on a cross. Nobody ever says that's not fair. You get all the benefits from it, and you didn't have to suffer and die, because what we do as human beings affects one another for the good or for the bad. Make sense? So there's original sin. It's this condition, this privation, this consequence of sin that came before us, and it's a privation of grace. Now in baptism, we'll get to that later, we receive sanctifying grace, and from that moment onward, God never abandons us. The only way you can be separated from God after that grace of baptism is by your own free will. By your own free will. And we'll get to that in a moment when we talk about sin. Okay? So that's original sin. We're going to take that. We're going to set that aside now. We're not going to talk about that anymore until baptism class. Now we're going to talk about personal sin. This is what I'm talking about. This is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about sin. Okay? Now let's consider this. Sin is an action. Sin is a free choice. It's a free-willed thought. It's a free-willed word. Or it's a free-willed action. It's something that you do or something that you skip doing. Omission or commission. But please understand, sin is a free choice. Can you sin by accident? No. Can you sin by being tempted?
Yes.
No. That people come into confession, they confess that they were tempted. And they're baffled when I tell them a temptation isn't a sin. It has to be a free decision. Okay? We'll talk about this later when we talk about morality at the end of the year. But think about the way our legal system works. You go into a courtroom and you try to figure out whether somebody's guilty or innocent. Is anybody prosecuted for making a mistake? No. The more they freely chose it, the more they're considered to be guilty or innocent, correct? First-degree murder, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, premeditated, planned. The more you're freely choosing it, the more you're either guilty for doing wrong or praiseworthy for doing right. Make sense? Please understand, sin is a free choice. You can freely choose to think a thought. Now, I'm not talking about a thought that races through your mind. It happens to everybody. Sometimes a thought races through your mind. You're like, where'd that come from? But sometimes a thought races through your mind and you say to yourself, oh, I like this thought. I'm going to hang out with this thought for a while. Maybe it's a vengeful thought. Maybe it's a lustful thought. But you're thinking about it. You're dwelling on it. You're mulling over it. Is that a free choice?
Yes.
Okay. A word. Sometimes you can have a knee-jerk reaction, say something, and you're like, why did I say that? Is that a free choice? Not really. Or maybe a tiny bit of free will. But when you really think about it, and then you say something really nasty to somebody, or really good for somebody, it's a free choice, right? An action. Again, that one's easier to understand. A sin, but it has to be a free-willed disobedience to God, a thought or a word or an action, something you do or something you skip. You understand how you can commit a sin by omitting something? I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I was supposed to water the neighbor's plants, but I felt like watching TV instead. I didn't water the neighbor's plants, and now the neighbor's plants are drying and risk of dying in the weltering summer heat. It can be an omission, but it's always a choice, okay? Let's go on a little bit further. People think of sin as breaking a rule. Very often people think of God up in heaven with his rules, and we're down here on earth, and God gets really mad when we break his rules. That is a big misunderstanding. You're never, ever sorry about breaking a rule. For example, what's the posted speed limit when you drive over here this evening?
40,
what's the other street? 25? You ever gone 26? Did you heave over the steering wheel and weep for sorrow afterwards? No, because it's a rule. So you go to the Target, and it's got 10 items or less, check out. You ever taken 11? Do you say an act of contrition afterwards? No, because it's a rule. Nobody's ever sorry for breaking a rule. People think of sin as breaking a rule. It is not breaking a rule. Let's talk about what it is. Sin destroys or hurts relationships. That's the only way you'll ever be sorry or understand that a sin is wrong. Now, I'm going to tell you, a sin is a free-willed thought, word, or action in disobedience to God's will. That's what it is. But what it does is it harms or breaks your relationships. Now, are you sorry when you've done something that's hurt a friend? Yes, of course. Are you sorry when you've done something that's upset, I don't know, somebody accidentally? Of course. When a relationship is harmed, you're sorry for it. You recognize the bad of it. What I want to try to tell you is every sin hurts relationships. That's why it's a big deal. It's not arbitrary. It's not a rule. It's not God sitting up in heaven saying, oh, you broke one of my rules. You know how mad that makes me up here? No, that's not it. But there's three basic relationships that you have. Now, I want you to think about this. You got a relationship with God, got a relationship with others, and you got, in a sense, a relationship with yourself. And sin either hurts or breaks all those relationships. Now, think about this. You might not have thought of a relationship with God before, but I hope this is something you will continue to think about every single day. You have a relationship with God Almighty. And the funny thing about your relationship with God is the more you sin, the more you think God has left you. And that's not true. God has not abandoned you. But when people commit big sins, they think, and I've been through this with people over decades now, trying to help people, trying to talk to people, they think, God will never forgive me for this. God will never forgive me for this. In fact, God is just as close to them as they've ever been before, but it has hurt their relationship with him. Does that make sense? Adam and Eve, in the Old Testament story, hid from God when they committed the sin. God didn't hide from them. Okay? So please understand, let's pretend like one of these Paris terrorist bombers has a big act of repentance. And maybe they run to, let's just make it simple and say they run to a priest. Say, can God ever forgive me for what I've done? He says, yes, God can forgive you for what you've done. But I killed 100 people. How could God ever forgive me? Sin makes us feel like God is far from us, can't forgive us, doesn't love us. But can I tell you something shocking? God is just as close to you in love before you sin, while you sin, and after you sin. He never abandons you. Little image I like to use for this. A man and a woman driving along in the car. One of those old cars with a great big bench seat, okay? Not bucket seats. And the man's got his hands right there on the steering wheel. And the woman, let's just say a wife of 35 years, is over there on the other side of the bucket seat, bench seat. And they drive up along and they see this young couple. And they are so close together, that young couple, driving along, they're both together in that front big seat. They are so close together, you couldn't put a piece of paper between them. They're so close. And the man's driving there, the woman's sitting over there, she says, why aren't we that close anymore? And the man, with hands on the steering wheel, says, I never moved. In a sense, that's what God says to us when we feel like he's a... Please understand that, okay? But it does destroy that sense of closeness to God. It damages it. It makes you feel like you're not worthy, not capable. Others, do I really need to tell you that sin hurts your relationship with other people? I don't need to explain that, do I? You lie. You deceive. You cheat. Let's pretend like, workplace... You embezzle. Everybody knows these stories make the news. Does anybody ever trust that guy ever again? He's fired and he has a very hard time ever finding a job again. Sin destroys the fabric of our relationship with one another. So far, so good? Now consider this one. This is one you might not have thought of. You actually have a relationship with yourself. Do you know what it means to say, I hate myself? Yeah. What I would like to tell you, do you know what it means to say, I love myself, I'm so proud of what I did? Sure. What I'd like to tell you is that every time you sin, you hate yourself a little bit more, whether you know it or not. Okay? It actually makes you... I knew a psychiatrist once, and he said, whenever someone does something that they know is wrong and do it anyway, It's only one of two things they ever do about it. Either they open up and out loud say, "I'm sorry," and they tell somebody, or they beat themselves up over it. It's all kinds of ways we punish ourselves. But what I want to tell you is that you know in your soul right and wrong. You might lie to yourself. You might not want to believe it, but you know in your soul right and wrong. And you feel like dirt after you do the wrong thing because you were supposed to have this wonderful relationship with yourself and a confidence and a goodness and a peace. Sin destroys that. So now think about this. If you can think of sin as costing you everything that you own, your peace of mind, your relationships with others, your relationship with God, now you can see it's why it's such a big deal. Make sense? Okay, relationships are all we have in life. That's it. That relationships are all that we have in life. Everything you own and everything you do exists for the purpose of a relationship. If it doesn't exist for the purpose of a relationship, it's a waste. So I'm driving through this former parish of mine, which is sprawling mansions, and I knew a man who had a separate garage for his Ferrari. So wealthy was this area. And I was with this friend, we were driving along, and he looked at one of these sprawling houses, and he kind of made this snide comment. He goes, "If I just build one more wing, I'm sure I'll be happy." Well, if it doesn't exist for the purpose of having some knowing and loving someone, and loving them knowing and loving you, it's a waste. A wing of a house can't make you happy, or a fancy car. It's all about a relationship. That's all we have. So when you think about our sin as destroying or hurting relationships, now you see why it's such a big deal. Okay? Now you see why it's such a big deal. So far, so good? Consider this. Sin actually really does harm us. Okay? It's like God has the owner's manual to the soul. He made you. He knows what is good for you, and he knows what's good for others. And he says, "Trust me." I think I gave you the example of the imaginary scenario of the man up there in the airplane, right? And with his friend, the pilot. They're in a two-seater airplane, and the pilot has a heart attack. And yeah. More man's guy gets on the phone on the radio and says, "Help! Help! I don't know how to fly a plane." Well, you do everything you were told to bring that plane down safely, because the guy on the other side, he has what's in your best interests. He has your best interests at heart. Sin really harms us. God has the owner's manual to the soul. He knows what's for our own good. Sin goes against our human nature. Sin takes away from our fulfillment as human beings. That's why we want to avoid it. So far, so good. Consider this now. Sin weakens the divine image in us. A little bit more about this now. Have you ever heard it said you're made in God's image? Raise your hand if you heard it said you're made in God's image. You know what that means? Let's talk about what that means. Here's what it means. It means that you have an intellect and a will. You don't act on instinct. An animal acts on instinct. You don't act on instinct. You have an intellect and you search for the truth. And you have a will and you search for love. That's why you will look up at the stars and ponder and wonder, or maybe you'll write a song, or maybe you'll write a poem, or you'll work out a piece of art. There's something in you that's expressing and longing and yearning. That's the divine image. Does that make sense? So far, so good? Okay. Consider what sin does now to the intellect and to the will. What I say is it weakens the divine image in you. Now, if you go back to his interesting story, you go back to 1947, I think it was. The first time they said that was when they invented the bikini. They couldn't find a woman who would model it. They couldn't find a woman who would be willing to model it. And then, you know, as time progressed more and more and more, and all this changed. But originally, there was this thought of, no, I can't do that. That's wrong. I'm not going to appear in public, you know, wearing that little. Consider what happens when someone chooses to do something that they know wrong. Let's talk about cheating on a test. A student cheats on a test. The first time they cheat on a test, they might really not want to cheat. Their mind is telling them, this is wrong, I shouldn't do this. But they turn and they cheat on the test anyway. The next time, isn't it easier for them to cheat on the test? Yeah. And after a while, They cheat on the test without even really giving it a second thought. I was a teacher in high school for 2 years, and I had to stop a kid just from overtly cheating. He was leaning over like this. That literally. I walked up, I just stood right there. Didn't give him the detention I should have. But he was mad at me. He was mad at me because I stood in the way of his cheating. Well, there was probably once a time when he didn't think the cheating was a good idea. What happened to his mind that once told him that was wrong? What happened to it? It slowly lost its ability to know the difference between right and wrong. Right? Make sense? And what happened to his will that once said, I don't want to do that, that's wrong? It slowly lost the ability to say, I'm not going to do that. Does that make sense? That's what I mean when I say sin weakens or destroys the divine image in you. It doesn't mean that you're dumber, but it does mean that you stop understanding the difference between right and wrong that once was really clear to you. And it does mean that you lose the ability to say, I'm not going to do that anymore, which once was really strong in you. Does that make sense? Okay. That's what sin does. Okay? And you can look at people like Pol Pot or Hitler or these people, and you say, how'd they get that way? One little choice at a time. That's how they got that way. Okay. So there's a kind of like little overview of what we mean by sin and why we say it's right or why we say it's wrong. Now let's take up another question. What happens when the church says something's a sin, but people in their mind think, well, I really don't think that's wrong? What happens? Let's take a real simple case. Let's imagine there's an island full of headhunters. Okay? And all these people have ever known is headhunting. Visitors come to the island, they get their heads hunted. Okay, that's what they do. No one's ever told them that headhunting is wrong. Along comes a missionary and he tells them, headhunting is wrong, you're not supposed to hunt heads. You're supposed to leave heads on shoulders where they belong, you're not supposed to lop them off. Do we say about the people who have been doing this thing that they thought was right, but now someone's coming along and telling them it's wrong? What do we make of that? Well, there's another little distinction here I want to make, and that's the difference between material sin and formal sin. Okay, so let's take a look at this. Material sin is what I mean when I say there's no intention to do something wrong, like the headhunter, okay? But something wrong has still been done. Maybe they acted out of ignorance, but they still did a wrong thing. They went against something God wills. What happens in a consequence like that? Well, if you really didn't know that what you were doing is wrong, you don't harm your relationship with God, but you do disrupt the fabric of society. Does that make sense? Let's talk about a more realistic example. Let's talk about Roma, you know, the Roma people, the gypsies. You go over to Italy, stand outside any major church in a major city, and you'll be approached by kids mumbling in a language they know you don't understand, giving you a crumpled up newspaper on an appeal that you're supposed to give them some money out of the sympathy for these poor people. And while one's pushing the newspaper into your chest, someone else is rifling through your pocket. Mm-hmm. And this is how they're raised. Okay. If they really don't know and they're acting out of complete ignorance that what they're doing is wrong, have they damaged their relationship with God? The answer is no. But have they still disrupted the fabric of society? Yes. Is there still something going on in their hearts somewhere at some level saying, I've done something wrong? Probably. Okay? Probably. but the most important thing to understand is that's what we will call a material sin. My favorite example is, I think I have it here on the... here you go. It's in your notes. A child scribbling on the wall with a crayon. He creates a great big mess. It's a problem. There shouldn't be a mess there. Does the mother now have a bad relationship with that child? Not really. She's upset that it happened, but she knows it was done out of complete innocence. When I was a little boy, I'll tell you a story. I grew up in Montana. And my mother went off riding horseback. And I went to look for her with my brother and a dog. We were out on this farm. And I went into the grain silo. I was about 3 years old. Mom was not in the grain silo. And I went into the barn with the cows. Mom was not in the barn with the cows. So I went into the chicken coop. Mom was not in the barn with the chicken coop, but I'll tell you, the dog had a field day killing chickens. He killed every chicken in the chicken coop. They're all dead. Their whole livelihood for that year. And I came back and I told my mother I was looking for her, and she was really sad that all these chickens were killed, but she knew I didn't do anything because I was too little to know. That's material sin. Does that make sense? Has there still been a problem? A fault? Yes. Are relationships destroyed? Not really. Okay. Let's talk about something else, though. Let's talk about formal sin. And when I'm talking about sin, as I've just been talking about it up until now, this is what I'm talking about. You go against God's will, and you know you're going against God's will. That's being culpable. Okay? That's being culpable. The essence of sin lies in the desire of the heart to do something that you know is wrong. That's being culpable. Okay? Now, there's two kinds of sin, right? Two kinds of sin. There's venial and there's mortal. Have you heard this distinction before? Raise your hand if you've heard this distinction before. Raise your hand if you've never heard this distinction before. Okay, well, the scripture tells us that not all sin is mortal, and it also tells us that the soul that sins shall die. So what I want to tell you just real briefly is there's two entirely different kinds of sin as far as what it does for your relationship with God. Let's talk about mortal sin first. This is three things, okay? It's something serious that you know you're doing wrong. We call that sufficient reflection. And that you fully consent to do anyway. Full consent to the will. That means no pressure, no habit, no threat, no force. We say that drives out God's grace from your soul because you've freely chosen it. Does that make sense? A serious thing. So let's talk about the prisoner of war who's threatened at gunpoint. You sleep with me or else I shoot you. And she does. Serious matter? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Sufficient reflection? Yes or no? Yes. Full consent of the will? Yes or no? No. Make sense? Mortal sin? Yes or no?
No.
No. Okay. Still not saying it's a good thing. And I'm saying it would have been a seriously heroic thing to die rather than to sin. Saints did that. I don't want to ignore that in the slightest. But it has to be a serious thing that you stop and think about. No knee-jerk reactions. You know what you're doing is wrong. And then with no pressure, habit, threat, or force, freely choose to do it. That is a big deal. Jesus died for that. That is what drives out grace from the soul. And why? Because effectively you've turned to God and said, I'd rather have my sin than my relationship with you. I know this is serious. I know it's against your will, but I choose not you. Does God force himself on anyone who chooses to turn away from him? He does not. He's a gentleman. You want to run away, you can run away. But don't pretend like your relationship with God isn't broken after that. It is. So far, so good? Okay. Anything other than that is what we call a venial sin. Venial sin doesn't mean a little sin or a sin that doesn't have any consequence. Here's an example of a venial sin, a relationship example. So I know a woman whose husband likes to smoke cigars. The woman hates cigars. Makes the house smell for 3 days. The husband knows the woman hates the smell of cigars. He smokes the cigars anyway. What does that do to their relationship? Does it destroy it? Does she divorce him now? Or is it weakened? Yes, that's venial sin. Does that make sense? You don't want to mess around with venial sin because you're supposed to love God and everything he tells you to do is good anyway. Okay, but still, out of weaknesses is what we do. But please don't think that a million venial sins can ever equal a mortal sin. It's different. It's totally different in its nature. Okay, serious matter, this is mortal sin. Serious thing, sufficient reflection, full consent of the will. So far, so good? Okay. Now, just a little overview here. I'm just going to glance over this. You ever heard of the seven deadly sins? You ever heard them called the cardinal sins? They're actually properly known as the capital sins, and here's why. It has nothing to do with the capital, although you'll find plenty of these broken in any capital in the world. But the idea here is the Latin word caput means head. Every sin in the entire world is somehow related to one of these. Pride, avarice, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. Pride. Pride does not mean I'm proud of my school. Pride does not mean I'm proud of my country. Pride does not mean I'm proud of my team. Pride means I think I'm better than you. That's the essence of pride. Pride is, I'm better than you. Don't you hate it when people are like that around you? The worst thing about pride is that you do that to God. Now, we could go on and on about that, but I don't have time. Avarice. Everybody hates greed, stinginess, fraud. Okay, avarice. Lust. A misuse of sexuality. We'll talk about this when we get to, probably when we talk about matrimony, we'll talk about the nature of sexuality and why it is the way it is. But it has a purpose and a plan and a reason. And what happens is what's meant to be giving and loving becomes taking and possessing. Do you see how that's a big deal when it's applied to a person? Yes. I think often women get this more than men do. Because women are naturally more relational than men are. Women are naturally more internal and relational. Men are kind of technical and external. And a woman will often recognize the wrongness of being used. Effectively, all of lust is being used. Does that make sense? I mean, I could go on and on about this, any one of these, but people will say, oh, you know, what's the harm, right? What's the harm in, looking at a picture of some lady, watching some pornographic image or movie or whatever. What's the harm in that? Nobody's hurt. What if that was your sister? And you know that men all over the world are looking at it. Now do you see how, okay, that's the problem with it. It's a real human being, and there's a purpose and a reason to it. So lust is the misuse of sexuality. Anger, everybody knows that. Gluttony, this one's hard for people to understand. But you ever seen The Simpsons? Everybody know who Homer Simpson is? Everybody knows that Homer Simpson downs donuts by the dozens, and we laugh at it. There's a misuse of food there. It's not the world's worst sin, but there's like a carnality there that is not what God intends. Okay, envy. Envy, you know the difference between envy and jealousy? There's a difference. Can I tell you real briefly? Envy is focused on a person. Jealousy is focused on a thing. When I'm jealous when my friend walks into the office and says, I just want a free trip to Hawaii. I think, oh man, I'd love to go to Hawaii. I'm envious when my friend walks in and says, I just want a free trip to Hawaii. And I think, oh, why you? See what I mean? Envy is person-centered. Jealousy is thing-centered. All right, sloth. Everybody knows what sloth is. I'll do it tomorrow. That's sloth. Okay. Please understand before we move on to grace, temptation is not a sin. Jesus was tempted. Everybody's tempted. You can be tempted to the point of being blue in the face. Is it a sin unless you freely consented to it? No. Please understand. Temptations can make you feel bad. Are they sins? No. Temptations are never sins. Please understand. Okay? Now, let's change gears. Shifting gears. We'll talk about grace for just a moment. Okay? Talk about grace for just a moment. And this one's really big. This whole topic is really big, but grace. Please know this definition and tattoo it onto your foreheads, okay? Grace is the life of God in your soul. What is grace? The life of God in your soul. What is your soul? Have I talked about this before? I'll probably say these things many times. But your soul is the real you. Please understand, your body changes every day, doesn't it? If only that your hair grew longer, your body changes every day. Your soul, that's your memory, that's your loves, that's your knowledge, that's your personality, that's all of the body. Let's talk about body. It's just physical, okay? That's when I'm talking about the body, that's all I'm talking about, just the physical here. It's got a certain weight, it's got a certain shape, certain height, that's just the way it is. But the real you is everything that's not physical. That's your soul. Here's the simplest definition of a soul. Go to a funeral home. Look in the casket. Ask, what's missing? Besides just life, what's missing? The personality, the memory, the everything that makes that person who they are. Does that make sense? That's your soul. Okay. God's life. God's life, well, we'll talk about the life of charity rather than selfishness. Okay? That's what grace is. God's life in your soul. Okay? That's what grace is. Now let's learn a little bit more about grace. The word grace comes from the Latin word gratia, which means free. It's a total free gift. It's just given away. You don't earn it. Total free gift. The Greek word for grace is charis, And it means beauty. And what we understand there is this, the beauty of God given away for free. Yes. Everybody knows about, say, the good example of Francis of Assisi. It's a beautiful thing. Let's pretend like over the shootings of the past, I'm just making this up out of thin air, but let's pretend like there was somebody who threw himself on a gunman so that other people would live. We would say that's a beautiful action that he did to save lives. What I want to tell you is that beauty that you'll see in a Francis or a Mother Teresa or someone who runs up the Twin Towers to save a life or a guy who throws himself on a hand grenade to save a buddy in a war, that beauty is what grace is. It's the beauty of the life of God. And I want to tell you, it's given away to anybody who wants it. Please understand, when we talk about grace, let's begin right there. It's something you really want. I didn't know what grace was for years. I didn't understand what it meant until I finally recognized grace is what you want your soul to really be like. Grace is what you want your personality to really be like. And God's given it away. That's why we call it grace. It means free. The word charis also means grace. It means beauty. Now, there's two places you get grace. Prayer and sacraments. We'll talk about sacraments later. Okay, when we start talking about the sacraments. But I'll have a quick little overview here of sacraments. A sacrament gives grace because Jesus himself promised that it would give grace. But it only gives as much as you want to take. It's not magic. Okay? You got those little terms there. Ex opere operato, ex opere operantis. We'll come back to those later. Okay, so grace, the life of God in your soul, given away for free. Now let's talk about what grace does. Grace reverses what sin did. Remember we talked about sin wrecking the relationships and the divine image in you? Grace brings them back. Grace restores relationships. Grace is that voice in you that says, you're not a bad person. Get up and make a new beginning. Grace is the beauty of forgiveness between two people that has a stronger relationship after the evil deed that ever existed before. Does that make sense? Same thing happens with our relationship with God. We recognize just how much he really does love us. Grace repairs what sin destroyed. Make sense? There's always this redemption. And then that weakness of your will that I talked about, that weakness of your mind, grace makes your will strong again. Grace makes it clear once again the right and the wrong. Okay? So one last little point here that we'll get to. There's two kinds of grace, just like there's two kinds of sin. There's sanctifying grace, and there's actual grace. Let's talk about this for just a moment. Sanctifying grace is the state of your friendship with God. So if you're in friendship with God, you have sanctifying grace. Actual grace, that's what we want to be paying attention to. Well, I mean, all of them we want to be paying attention to, but actual grace is the grace that comes in a moment to do the right thing. You ever had that little inspiration of maybe I should forgive that person, or that little inspiration of maybe I should turn back and help, or that little inspiration of maybe I should slow down and, you know, not be so pushy, or that little inspiration of whatever it might be, maybe I should hold my tongue? That's an actual grace. And the word actual doesn't mean actual as opposed to theoretical. It means actual as in a specific act. In this action, in this moment, I've got an opportunity, a grace that God wants to give me to help me. I like to say it's like wind for a sailboat. The wind comes and the sailboat catches the wind and it moves and it goes somewhere. When you respond to these actual graces, God gives you more. And when you reject them, he gives you fewer. Why is that? Because in all of this, it's a relationship. Please understand. You understand the whole of the Christian life if you understand the whole thing is a love relationship. If you love somebody and you make an overture to them, maybe a friendly word, and they respond with another friendly word, you give them more friendly words, right? The relationship grows. If they're cold to you, you back off. You don't stop loving them. Talk about a parent and a child. Everybody knows stories of parents with a child who's gone astray, right? Does a parent ever stop loving the child? I sure hope not. But the child's going to lose the closeness of the friendship if the child doesn't respond to those overtures, those invitations. It's like that with us and God. He keeps offering opportunities for us to do the right thing, and we decide at that moment, are we going to draw closer to him or are we going to draw away from him? Make sense? When you say yes to grace, you get more of them. When you reject them, you get fewer of them. Okay? You grow stronger or you grow weaker. The last little idea here is grace always, always, always comes first. When you think to yourself, I really ought to turn back and help that person, even that thought is a grace. God always, always, always invites, and we respond. Okay? If you want a little examination of conscience, you can look here on that last page, because Paul, in his letter to the Galatians, talks about signs that you're filled with grace or that you're lacking in grace. Here's signs that you're lacking in grace: immorality, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, hatreds, rivalry, jealousy, outbursts of fury, acts of selfishness, dissensions, factions, occasions of envy, drinking bouts. Basically sounds like the evening news. Okay? Signs that you're filled with grace: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. They're the fruits of the Holy Spirit. But there it is in brief as I can make it: sin and grace.